Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And welcome to the Carol the Coach Show. Hey, I'm Carol the Coach, a.k.a. Carol Jorgensen Sheets, directly from Indianapolis, Indiana, doing the only sexual addiction show on iTunes and on Blog Talk. And I got to tell you, I feel very privileged to be with you tonight. I especially feel very, very humbled because of the people that I get to interview every single week. You know, they're experts in the field all over the world. Tonight, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Charles Rawlings, and he wrote a book, It Really Is That Complicated, which I love the name of that book because, let's face it, relationships are complicated no matter what the issues. And so he's going to be talking about the fallacies of relationships as well as the real-world state of affairs that describes the interaction of couples. And if you have been in a relationship, then you know that when you have a sexual addiction, it can create great drama, trauma, and pain. I know you probably know what I'm going to say next, that it's the addict that carries around the shame, but it's the partner who carries around the pain. And what I mean by that is, truly, when I work with couples, the sex addict and his or her partner, the people that I'm really treating the pain happens to be the partner. Now, addicts who carry around the shame actually do have pain. More than likely, they've got pain from childhood. So I'm not minimizing the horrendous pain that you may have experienced as an addict in your childhood. You know, you've heard me say it before. A lot of times, sexual addiction is trauma reenactment. And that means that you are reenacting some trauma that you experienced as a child. And, you know, when I do an assessment of people, and, for instance, today I met with a man. He had no childhood trauma. His behavior was truly behaviors that had been ingrained as habits in his life. Now, there's no doubt that in his sexual timeline, his history, he had certain things that had aroused the template. We call that a template arousal or an arousal template. And that had a significant impression on his life, which then carried over into sexual addiction. But that's a lot easier to people that have had huge, major traumas. And so I'm a believer in you need to work through the childhood wounds. And in for instance, this guy's case, the one that didn't have any childhood traumas. His treatment of choice is going to be helping him to develop the infrastructure necessary to stay on the right road. And that in and of itself is not nearly as difficult. Now, in the book, it really is that complicated. We're going to be talking about relationships, life. And this author examines topics as diverse as marriage, sex, land, money, matchmaking, escorts, hookers, women as prostitutes. No stone in the relationship is left unturned. So I look forward to actually working with him, as well as, I got to tell you, I am so grateful for my listeners on the show. I had a client contact me today, and he said, "Hey, Carol, I want you to know you're making a difference." Now, again, I'm out of Indianapolis, Indiana. I have done radio shows for the last decade on air, you know, that are live on FM and AM stations. So this is one of my loves. It's one of my passions. And I thought, you know, why not do a sexual addiction show? Kind of help people to figure out what is it that they need, what do they need to do, where can they turn. It's all very important to me. So my client says, "I want you to know you're really making a difference. I was talking to a friend in Atlanta. Actually, it is a connection that he was given by his sponsor to call this mentor in Atlanta to talk about a certain issue. And the Atlanta mentor said to him, 'Hey, let's call this guy Tom. Hey, Tom, in addition to what I'm telling you, I really think you need to listen every week to this woman's show. She has this podcast, and it's really helpful, and it'll keep you on track.' Well, Tom contacted me and said, hey, he was flabbergasted to find out that you are my therapist, Carol. And he said, 'Wow, I can't believe you actually get to work with her.' Well, I had to giggle. I had to grin because, you know, so many people say this is dark stuff, and it sure can be. But at the same time, what I say to everybody is working in the field of sexual addiction is like working with your neighbor, your brother, your minister, your doctor, your attorney. I mean, the majority of people that have concerns are normal people that have gone astray. Again, they've either reenacted a trauma from their childhood or they've gotten into some deep, serious behaviors that they need to curtail. And so I'm not working with pedophiles, although there can be some pedophiles that have sexual addictions. And I don't even in any way dismiss them as people that I wouldn't want to work with. I don't work with them because I'm in a situation where it wouldn't be right to have a pedophile come to my waiting room. There are other kids in the waiting room, and I want to honor not only the children, but also the addict. But the majority of people I work with really are normal people who want to get healthy, and they're wanting to know how to do that. You know, sometimes that means that I have to encourage the person to experience his anger or her anger in an externalized way. Today I gave a homework assignment. I said, you know what? You are resentful. You're resentful for the way that you were treated as a child. And now you're a grown adult, you're 48, and it's time for you to get in touch with that anger so you can let it go, surrender to it, and move on. But you can't do it until you really acknowledge it. And so I asked him to write two letters. One, a very civil letter to his father, who had abused him physically in a horrible way, and he's to do it in a civil way. You know, kind of explaining exactly why he's so resentful. Then secondly, he is to write a letter that's venomous. It's ugly. It's despicable. It's horrible. It's the kind of letter you would never want anybody to see. And he's to bring it back, and actually he's in one of my groups, so he's to bring it back in group and share the letter with everybody else. Now, you know, we're finding out more and more that people that externalize anger don't necessarily end up doing better or feeling better unless there's a real release process and a forgiveness process. So that will be the next step we'll take. I'm wondering if you're angry about something, you, the listening audience, is there something that you're upset about, something that you are absolutely controlled by? I would encourage you to get to a certified sexual addiction therapist and work out those feelings of anger, because unless you do, you aren't going to get healthy. You know, so much of what we do is encapsulated by the three circles, which in the SAA program is the healthy behaviors, the middle circle behaviors, which are slippery slope behaviors, and the inner circle behaviors. And I want you to know what are those behaviors that you absolutely won't participate in, the inner circle behaviors, and what can you do to stay out of the middle circle behaviors that can lead you into trouble, and what can we do to enlarge the healthy circle behaviors? You know, when I first started working with this population, when I heard that there were a lot of men that probably couldn't, well, men and women, but really it was mostly men, that couldn't masturbate, I thought, oh my gosh, I can't imagine that somebody would be able to participate in abstention from that. And then I realized how necessary it was, that it lit up the reward center, that it was a hit in the brain that triggered a lot of unconscious, subconscious, and conscious behaviors that led into sexual addiction. And what I found with the guys that I work with is that if they don't masturbate, they are more likely to have success because their brain is not ramped up. And when their brain isn't ramped up, they can do the work they need to do. Now, it's the same thing with sex. You know, oftentimes in this field, we ask for couples to abstain from sex for a certain amount of time just so that whoever the sex addict is can get a handle on what they need to do to stay clean and sober. It's not something that we ask for that person to do forever. It is something that we ask temporarily to calm down the brain. That's why we use an addiction, some addiction jargon that goes one day at a time. You don't think about how you're never going to do it. You think about, I can do it. I cannot do it today. You know, I can't guarantee tomorrow, but I can say today that I won't masturbate or I won't have sex. And, of course, then we focus on all the other things that help to enlighten and reinvent a client's life. So it is just imperative that there are certain things you got to give up, but you know what? When you give something up, you're getting so much back. And I can't emphasize enough how it's so important to create healthy behaviors that help a client to really decide what it is they need to do to make their life better. And so, again, I'm so grateful. If you have a question and you want to email that to me, all you have to do is email carolthecoach@aol.com. Or you can go to my website, www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach, or my larger website for everybody. I mean, you could advise your husband or wife to go to that website, is carolthecoach.com. And get some information about healthy relationships, what you need to do when you're fighting, how do you find relationships, how do you create a family of origin when you don't have a healthy family in your own life. It is the place to go to get information that will create healthiness. So again, you know this is a show that gives you the skills that you need to create a healthy life, and that's why we interview the experts. And tonight we are interviewing Dr. Charles Rawlings, and he wrote, "It Really Is That Complicated." And again, what an honest title for a book. So, Dr. Rawlings, welcome to the Carol the Coach Show. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing, Carol? It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk with any relationship expert, and certainly your book is enlightening. It's honest, it's forthright, and it gives people hope because you don't mess around. You talk about the realities of relationships.
Well, thank you. I certainly try to. Let's put it that way. And, yes, certainly at the end, I try to give people hope. Absolutely. Try to be positive.
Yeah, so what prompted you to write this book?
Probably, there's a short answer and a long answer, so I'll give you sort of the medium answer. After I was divorced, I started going out and dating folks, and I met some very interesting women and had some very interesting experiences. And I would come back and I would talk to my friends about the experiences and what I was learning and what I was seeing, and some of the things just really amazed me about folks' relationships and how they interacted with other people and the opposite sex and looking at some of the issues there. So my friends were telling me, they said, you know, you are a mature, evolved male. You've got these insights into people and relationships and how they interact with each other. Instead of telling us, why don't you write a book? And so I thought about it for a while and decided that, okay, I think that's an excellent idea. So a group of friends and I got together over a weekend, and in about an hour or two, we came up with probably the majority of the chapter's contents, and that's how it started.
You know, that is so interesting because obviously you took a great idea and you coupled that with a whole support network and you came up with the outline over a weekend's time. Now, can I ask you,
yes, ma'am,
because clearly you said there was a short answer and a long answer and you were going to give us the medium answer. How did you feel at the time of your divorce? What feelings were going on and what thoughts were you having?
Well, I was more concerned about my kids than I was anything, and I wouldn't say facing an uncertainty, but just trying to get back into, you know, meeting people and relationships.
So then you would say that your main concern obviously was the kids because, first and foremost, that's what any adult should worry about. It's the kids. And then secondly, you wondered how to get back into the environment and create the life you deserved and the relationship that you really wanted.
I think that would be fair. I mean, for a while, I really didn't go out. I just was trying to get my feet back under me and interacting with my friends and building up, I wouldn't say it necessarily a support network, but just putting your life, you know, back in order just from an organized standpoint.
Yeah, and, you know, by support network, I mean that you have a group of people that you absolutely depend on for validation of who you are, as well as for that environment in addition to your family with the kids. I mean, you've got to have your own life. And so, obviously, if you were skilled enough to get a group of people together to talk about what this book should look like, you did have a support network.
I'm not going to argue that I didn't have a support network, but I'm pretty aware of myself, and I know my own inner core, and so I don't necessarily know that they were validating anything, but they were certainly there, and I bounced ideas off of them, and we had a great deal of fun coming up with the ideas in the book, and they were, you know, they ranged all the way from married couples to a friend of mine who's an escort, and it was just a totally different environment in terms of seeing how each person reacted and how each person dealt with relationships.
So let me ask you, you say in the book that in a relationship, the one who holds the power to the person is the one that cares the least. Now, explain that to our listening audience.
Absolutely. It's just listening to it or reading it, it's somewhat counterintuitive. But when you start thinking about it, the light bulb always comes on when the people start thinking, going, you know, that's right. A good example, and I'll get to sort of the substance, a good example is you ask any woman almost, and she will tell you that some mature woman in her life has always told her, marry a man who loves you a little bit more than you love him. And that's sort of a corollary to that statement. And if you think about it, if a person has an issue or a desire or an object that they really want, they have imbued it with a great deal of power and energy, and they have to go and convince the other person in the relationship or in the marriage or what have you that it is something that they should also invest their power and their energy into. So the person who cares the least about the person and say, you know, I really don't care about this. I don't think we should do it. I don't think we should get into that situation. I don't like you as much as you like me. And once all that is said, then the other person who has all the energy invested into it has to work even harder to convince the other person that whatever is at issue is worth their time and effort and energy and whatever it is. So the person who cares the least has the most power.
Well, you know, I 100% agree with you, although I would say that that person either has the most confidence and doesn't need another person to complete them, a.k.a. they're not codependent, or they have kept a certain amount of boundaries up to not need another person. So, you know, they don't rest their entire sense of self on somebody else. Now, I agree that clearly you hear very often that a woman should find a man who loves them a little bit more than they love that person. I'm not so sure that I think that's healthy either, but that's for another day. I want to ask you another question. You know, obviously you said that person holds the power. Do you think that that person then abuses because they hold that sense of power?
I could almost guarantee, listening to your comments, that this is where we were headed. And I think the honest answer is yes, absolutely sometimes. There's no question about that they can abuse that power and they can use it to manipulate the other person into doing something possibly that they don't necessarily want to do to ensure that they get what they want. So it can absolutely be abused. It can absolutely be seen occasionally as manipulative, and it can also be seen as dysfunctional, absolutely.
Yeah, see, and what I'm always trying to do with my listeners, because, you know, this is a show about sexual addiction, and it's a show about people that are in recovery. So they're creating healthy sexual and emotional behaviors. And one of the top behaviors that I ask my clients to develop is the behavior and the skill of empathy, which means they're able to put themselves in another person's shoes and operate from their own shoes as well as being able to negotiate what's going on with that other person. Now, you have this term, and it's called psychodynamic whores. And, you know, it's applied to most marriages and relationships. And I wanted you to describe to our listening audience, because, again, that term, psychodynamic whores, comes from, it really is that complicated. And, of course, I'm talking with Charles Rawlings tonight. So tell us a little bit about what that terminology means.
Sure. And I guarantee you're familiar with the concepts that I'm going to just briefly talk about just from your background and your education. But it's what I'm talking about primarily in the book is the baggage that people bring to a relationship, their childhood traumas, their experiences, their reactions to their experiences, the filters that they use to interpret another person's actions or speech or words, whatever you have, and it's sort of like the old continuous tape, the same video that is played over and over again when someone encounters a trigger. It's what it essentially is they encounter a trigger, and the old video or tape starts rolling in their head again, and they play it out, and they don't stop to think about what's actually happening. And so when I talk about the psychodynamic horrors, that's what I'm discussing in terms of the relationship, the baggage people bring, the filters they use, and whatever their partner is doing may trigger this, it may not. But if it does get triggered, that's what you're going to see coming out of this particular person. And it just becomes even more entrenched as the relationship goes forward, unless the people learn to evolve and trust and respect each other.
So good. Give us some real-life examples of some of those psychodynamic whores, or as, you know, as you just commonly referred it to, as the baggage that somebody brings into a relationship.
I think a really good sort of general example of that is something like giving gifts. That's always it's done commonly, but it's also something that really can trigger people. Like, gifts are given for all types of reason. Sort of an evolved reason to give a gift is that you want to respect the person, recognize the person on, say, a birthday or an anniversary, and you give them a gift that you hope and that they want. And a lot of people give gifts because they're trying to change the person or trying to impress the person, or giving them a gift that they want the person to have because then it might trigger another change in behavior, so to speak. Like a husband may give a wife a year's membership in a gym. I've seen that happen a lot. And what it is, it's not respecting the woman or his wife. It's not so subtly saying, you need to get in shape, go to the gym, and here it is. Another interesting psychodynamic horror is folks interacting in terms of like chores around the house. When I say jobs, like chores around the house, where they try and divide up who does what. And a lot of times this kicks into childhood experiences of being given a list by the parents or someone and told to do something. And just little things can be triggers to this type of underlying baggage that they're carrying, well, since childhood or whenever, and they react as if they're being, you know, told to do something as a child would be told to do, but all they're really sort of discussing is who's taking out the garbage or who's doing the dishes. And those are two of the examples I see really frequently.
No, I would agree with that 100%. And I know that childhood trauma or that childhood issue then gets misinterpreted in real relationships. And then what typically can happen is that the person who feels that way gets angry and does some projecting, and the partner goes, what the heck is going on with this, and gets defensive too. And then they're in a huge power struggle, and, you know, they're fighting about absolutely nothing, but it is something because it's what was represented in that person's past. You know, I interviewed one of the greats, Dr. John Gottman, who wrote Seven Principles of Success in a Marriage, and when he asked people, what do you fight about, there has been all sorts of research that indicates marital couples fight first about division of duties, second about money, and third about sex. So when he said, what do you think couples fight about? That's what all the clinicians yelled out. Division of duties, chores, sex, money. And he said, no, you know what? Couples actually fight about nothing. But if you peel away the nothing, there's a huge issue from the past that they're carrying around as baggage. And I think that's what you would refer to as a psychodynamic core.
Absolutely. And I would agree completely with what you just said. It ends up fighting about nothing, but it's because there is something much deeper that they're trying to discuss and figure out.
100%. Now, you talk about in the book a lot of different dynamics. And what do you think is the most positive aspect of your book? What do you hope that readers will get from this book?
I would not hesitate to say that the most positive aspect is that people don't necessarily have to go through life doing or being involved in the psychodynamic horrors or the filters that they bring. What they need to recognize is that they need to learn about themselves, figure out what it is, what they like about themselves, just figure out themselves first and foremost, and then have no fear. Don't worry about anything. Just be honest. Don't have any filters. Be able to see what you're doing. And then just go out and experience and enjoy life. Live each moment for the present and know yourself and have no fear.
I'm sorry, did you hear me? I think we broke up for a second. How would you suggest that they face their fears, you know, and create that positive aspect? All right, I'm sorry. I think we dropped you for a second. Now, you were talking about
We're having a major ice storm, so I don't know whether it's the lines or what it is.
You're having an ice storm. Now, where are you calling from?
North Carolina.
Okay, yes, you are having an ice storm. Well, that's okay. I just clicked back in and found you. Now, you know, you were really talking about the positive aspects of the book, and you said, you know, really people have to kind of face their fears. And I'm wondering, what would you suggest? How would you tell people to face their fears?
I think the very first thing you need to find out is to know yourself, be able to actually understand where your fears are coming from. And fear itself is really a psychological reaction to an unlikely, improbable future event. So if you start looking at the fear and you break it down like that, you're really not scared of anything at present time. You're more worried about what might happen possibly sometime in this improbable future. And once you start looking at it from that standpoint, your fear just pretty much drops away.
Well, that's a good point, that most fears are not based on reality. They're either based on the past and what has happened to you before, or they're based on the future, what you fear is really going to happen to you. So I like that you also agree that fear is really unrealistic because it doesn't deal with the real life moment. Now, just kind of share with me for a second. You divorced in what year?
Oh, I'm trying to think. '06, I believe it was. '05, something like that.
Okay, so clearly you've had 7, 8, or 9 years to kind of recover from the marriage, recover from the divorce, and deal with the reality of what life has to bring you today.
Absolutely.
Do you think your book has helped you to cope and function better?
That's an interesting question. The answer is partly yes, but the book was written, just a year or so ago, and it really is a culmination of getting to know myself better and really having no fear. So when I say it's partially yes and partially no, the partially yes is sure, it makes it much more real when you write it down and put a pen to paper. But the thoughts that are in there, while they coalesced during the writing, were what I had brought to myself over the years before I wrote the book. So it is sort of a yes and a no answer.
Well, and that makes sense, totally. And you gave yourself plenty of time before you decided to write the book. Now, what would you say is the most controversial part of the book?
I would say there are probably a couple of controversial parts of it. First, the one that we've mentioned before is the power phrase. People get upset or take offense to that, and then when they start thinking about it, they get that idea. The other somewhat controversial aspect of it is the financial aspects, the economic aspects of dating, and people can get very upset about that because, you know, women many times don't recognize the fact that there is an economic aspect to dating and that men do spend money on them, and whether they like to think about that or not, they expect, you know, that men will spend money on them for the first date, second date, or whatever. You know, I've had women come up to me and say, you know, they could have taken me to McDonald's. And I'm like, really? That statement just came out of your mouth. Think about it for a minute. Do you really think you would date a guy who would take you to McDonald's on the first date? And once they start thinking, they're like, well, no, probably not. I do, you know, they don't necessarily have to fly me to Paris for the first date, but they at least have to do something to show me that they like me or impress me or something like that. And so that can be very controversial as well.
Now, you know, you wrote a very controversial chapter in your book, and it's like, it was something like, all women are prostitutes. Can you explain what you mean by that, because obviously I'm dealing with men and women who exploit people for their own sexual gains. And so in this relationship book, you're saying all women are prostitutes, and I want to hear what you think here, because I'm probably going to challenge you.
Well, that's fine. The title of the chapter is very controversial, and it was meant that way somewhat on purpose, just to get people to start thinking about it and to read the chapter. And in fact, that was the one chapter heading that brought up a great deal of controversy among my friends. And in fact, the woman who was the escort had the greatest problems with it. Like, basically, you just can't say that. No one will read it. Blah, blah, blah. Prostitution has such a bad connotation. That sort of stuff. But I kept the chapter title. And what we really were talking about in the chapter title are the economics of dating. What it costs to date. And the fact that, and I, you know, when I say all women are prostitutes, I am not excluding men. This happens with men all of the time. And it is, what can I get, or what do I have to give to get something? And that's really what it boils down to, is what do you have to give to get something in return? And people, you know, prostitution obviously is from a is seen, connoted as a sexual exchange, but that's not necessarily what it has to be. It can be, I want to do this if you'll give me this. Or I want to be comfortable and have security, so you give me this, and I'll give you that. It's a power exchange as much as it is anything.
Yeah, and I think that I would definitely agree with that, although don't you believe that two people can compromise and negotiate what they want from each other without one person exploiting the other?
Absolutely. And I think that is an evolved relationship where both people are seen as partners, and it's much, if you want to get down to it, it's much like a business partnership. They come to the table, they negotiate what they want, each person is happy, and they evolve. And absolutely, I think that is totally, absolutely 100% correct. It takes people who know themselves, who respect the other, who are have a great deal of trust in the other person, and trust in themselves, and are mature enough and evolved enough to have a serious discussion like that. And those types of relationships are few and far between.
So now let me ask you, one of the chapters deals with the fact that females are so attracted to the bad boy type. And here's the deal. I think to some degree you're right, because they're exciting and they're stimulating and they keep a woman on their toes until they really have them engaged in a one-on-one relationship. And, of course, a bad boy is not really going to be able to meet the needs of a woman. And women really do want to develop trust and to increase communication. And so tell me a little bit about why you think females are so attracted to the bad boy type.
I would totally agree with your lead-in into that question. What I would somewhat disagree with in the premise of part of that chapter is that women think they want trust, and they think they want security, and they think they want this and that, but they really don't know themselves, or many of them don't. And so that's why they keep mouthing the words, I want to trust the person, I want to have a relationship, I want to be monogamous, I want this and I want that. And what they're really doing is deluding themselves, because they don't know themselves. They don't want that, and that's why they keep going back to what we term the bad boys, the guys who don't tell them they love them, don't give them security, don't communicate. And my premise also that's really not spelled out well in the book is that it's okay if you want to date you know, a bad boy, but don't delude yourself into saying, I need security, or I want security, or I want someone who is loving and nice to me. Don't delude yourself. Just say, look, it's okay if I want to date this guy who doesn't call me back, or I want to be a serial dater. That's okay as long as you know that's what you want. But once you set up that dichotomy in your own mind that you think you want this when subconsciously you don't want that and you want that, that's when you set up loss of self-esteem and other things in the person's own viewpoint. But once you get to know what you really want, then, hey, that's fine too.
Well, yeah, and when you explain it like that, that absolutely makes sense. And, again, it has to do with the person, whether they want the bad boy or the bad girl, really knowing themselves and deciding what is it that they want out of a relationship, because more than likely the bad boy or the bad girl is not going to give him what they, give them what they want. Now, can you explain why relationships really are that complicated? I mean, it is the name of your book. So tell me, why did you name the book that, and why do you think relationships are so doggone complicated?
Well, I think over the past 20 minutes, we've pretty much figured out why they're complicated. It really boils down to the fact that it's human relationships. It's two people dealing, and, you know, I say two people, it may even be three or four people dealing with human beings in a relationship. And everyone brings their own baggage. Everyone has their own ideas. Some people are more involved than the other person. There's this subterfuge going on. There's manipulation going on. And after a while, once you get into the relationship, it becomes very complicated because you have all these interacting factors and you have these folks, these humans, who are trying to deal and make up a relationship. It's that complicated because they're human beings.
And yet when you say that, I agree that human beings are very complicated, and yet healthy human beings don't have this much trouble. So I think you're speaking to people who have maybe not had the best role models, or maybe aren't secure within themselves. And so your book is for people that really tend to struggle with that. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I would even take that further. I would say that most people, the majority of people, in relationships or who are looking for relationships, who are dating, struggle with relationships. I think that it is a very rare couple who know themselves, who trust each other, who are evolved enough to be able to make it simple. And that's why it's complicated, just because I think the vast majority of folks make it complicated and are complicated and don't and are dysfunctional and have had bad role models or have had something somewhere that causes problems in a relationship.
Now, you know, I want to know, have you found anybody that's a good fit for you?
I would say on occasion, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I tend to gravitate towards more evolved people, and that's not being, you know, arrogant or anything. It's just I enjoy people who are independent, who know themselves, and so and I've also gotten to the point that I just don't like drama in my life, and that once drama shows up or once something happens like this, I'll certainly discuss it, but it's not going to last very long.
Okay, so you've evolved to the point where you're picking healthier people, and you get that if they're the drama queen, it's probably not the right person for you.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you have a number of interesting, unusual quotes beginning each chapter. Explain why you chose them and a few of their meanings.
Okay. Well, let's see. There's one in particular that I like. It actually, I think, starts off chapter one, if I'm not mistaken. It says, stand in your space and know you were there. And it starts chapter one primarily because it's a quote designed to sort of, I want to say, jostle folks, jostle people, saying that this is your space, know yourself, and know you are standing in that space. You know, be aware, don't be afraid to take your space, and, you know, and know what you're about, know yourself. Another interesting one that always – yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and, you know, again, that's really speaking to know who you are and have the confidence to know who you are. So you're really saying, come on now, let's go ahead and put yourself first before a relationship.
Absolutely. And once you know yourself – and you're comfortable with yourself, you're a much better partner.
Absolutely. So the next quote?
The next quote is also has always gotten a bit of raised eyebrows. It's, love is the delusion that one woman differs from another. And I put that in there, not being derogatory, but more of a self-reflection, because the emotion of love is coming from, you know, in this instance, the male. So it's the male who's feeling the love, and it's his emotion, and it's his way of deluding himself. And I use delusion, deluding is more of a hoodwinking of himself, that this woman is different than other women that he sees, for whatever reason it may be. And you could flip it around just as easily, saying love is a delusion that one man differs from another, and just flip it back on the women. But it's more the fact that love, that affection, comes from one person, and it's not necessarily that that other person differs from another person significantly.
Okay, now I got to think about that. So you really believe that people don't differ that much from each other?
I think you can look at it superficially that sure, people differ from one another, but once you get down into the inner psychic core, that no, not really, not necessarily.
Okay. Interesting. Now, I don't know that I believe that, because I think we're all evolved to a degree whereby we are able to cope better or like ourselves better. We put ourselves first, or maybe we don't. Maybe we're codependent. We put somebody else first. To me, that sets each one of us apart in terms of our own development. Would you agree with that?
I do. I agree with that. Absolutely.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that the partner interprets that as being different than other people in a way that attracts them from a love standpoint.
Okay. And so in knowing that separates them from other people, and it also would create their desire to be with a certain type of person, you know, you've obviously are writing to people that are kind of confused, that maybe are disillusioned about relationships, want some helpful advice as to what to do, what's the wake-up call for them. And so as we end for today, tell the listening audience, why do you think people should read your book?
Being the author and not wanting to tout it in a self-serving way, it's a book written by an evolved male who is older than, say, a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old. And in this book, there are all types of scenarios and different types of relationships that almost every person that has read it or has even read a chapter of it will say, I've seen that person. I've been in that situation. I know what you're talking about. I get this. I've seen this. And they look at it as saying, I can relate to this. I can relate to maybe not all of the book, but at least part of it. And they always come back and say, you know, that's a good idea, or that's exactly what was happening, and that is exactly what I should have done. So it's a practical sort of worldly view on issues, experiences that you'll see in the real world.
Well, I definitely think as I was reading this book, I thought to myself, you know, this guy, Dr. Charles Rawling, he is somebody who really feels a lot of the feelings of the general public. I mean, it's not that you stereotype, but you bring out the issues that so many people feel. And we've talked about them tonight. You know, a woman should find somebody who loves them a little bit more than they love. And, you know, that we are oftentimes magnetized to those people that are mirrors for us. And so I so appreciate the fact that you contributed to this, that you and your friends got together and came up with an outline and kind of dealt with many of the stereotypes of what relationships are all about. In our final words, is there anything else you would like to share with our listening audience?
I would just reiterate to everyone who's listening is know yourself, don't be afraid, live life to its fullest, and be present every moment, and don't worry about the future and the fear that you think is out there, and just know yourself.
And that's very good advice. Thank you, Charles, for everything you've had to share with us today, and stay warm, stay safe in North Carolina, and looking forward to reading more about what you may be contributing 10 years from now.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Have a good night.
Thank you very much.
All right. So, boy, he had an interesting take on relationships, and I think that he would represent a lot of people. Definitely you want to take what you need and leave the rest. And, you know, this is a show where people can get on the air and talk about things that they really feel strongly about. Now, next week, you know, we are going to be talking with an expert in the field of certified sexual addiction. We've got Tim Stein, who's going to be talking about attachment issues. So I look forward to dealing with Tim and sharing his thoughts and philosophies about how abandonment affects sexual addiction. You are listening to Carol the Coach, and as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week.